In the World Service of the BBC, this is Zainab Badawi with NewsHour. Coming up in the next 60 minutes after the killing of unarmed ethnic Albanians, Serb forces enter again. What can and will NATO do? The next chapter in the Pinochet legal saga has begun as seven British law lords begin deciding if he does have immunity from prosecution. Kofi Annan says he wants the UN out of Angola because of the civil war. Has the UN failed there? And what effect has the explicit Anwar trial had on sexually conservative Malaysians?
There is a very strong feeling among Malaysian women and men that the children are being affected. And this is so, so tragic.
First, the news in detail. It's read by Guy Francis.
BBC World Service. Serbian security forces with armoured vehicles and heavy weapons have again been in action in southern Kosovo. Gunfire broke out in Racak, scene of a massacre of ethnic Albanians on Friday. The renewed fighting comes as the chief prosecutor from the International War Crimes Tribunal, Luis Arba, prepares to try to reach the village to inspect evidence of the massacre. So far, Belgrade has refused to allow tribunal investigators into the province. Our correspondent, Paul Wood, has just filed this report on the renewed violence.
International monitors say that around 200 special police troops fanned out across the ridge overlooking the village of Racak early this morning. Automatic gunfire is continuing this afternoon, along with what sounds like heavy weaponry. The monitors say the police are being supported by tanks from the Yugoslav army. Racak itself is completely deserted. In the main street, the only sound is the intermittent crump of tank fire or mortar fire. The more than 40 bodies from the alleged massacre by the security forces are still lying in the village mosque, the relatives too scared to take them for burial.
The highest court in Britain, a panel of judges in the House of Lords, has reopened deliberations on whether the former Chilean leader, General Pinochet, is immune from extradition. He's wanted in Spain to face charges of torture and murder during his 17 years in power. Andy Tai is following the hearing and has sent this report.
Seven law lords, some of the most senior judges in the land, will sit at this unprecedented second hearing to decide the fate of the former Chilean leader, currently under house arrest outside London. The first time this case came before the Lords, the general was denied immunity and the extradition case against him was due to proceed. But then one of the peers, Lord Hoffman, was found to have links with the human rights group Amnesty International, and the ruling was set aside and a fresh panel of law lords selected for another hearing. Amnesty International will make a submission to the law lords this week, as will, for the first time, representatives of the Chilean government, who are expected to argue that General Pinochet should only have to face trial in his own country.
The United Nations Secretary-General Kofi Annan has called for an end to the UN peacekeeping mission in Angola. He says the peace process has collapsed and the country is now in a state of war. The UN blames both the UNITA rebels and the Angolan government, which has itself called for the international force to leave. The BBC UN correspondent says Mr. Annan's report is one of the bleakest and angriest in years, and his recommendation is likely to be endorsed by the Security Council in the next few days. The former president of Zimbabwe, Kenan Banana, has been sentenced to 10 years in jail with Labour, nine of them suspended, following his conviction in November of homosexual assault. Four of the suspended years are conditional on him paying compensation of around $12,000 to his victims. Mr. Banana is appealing against both the conviction and the sentence and is not expected to serve the remaining one-year jail term pending the appeal. Mr. Banana, who fled to South Africa shortly before he was convicted, returned home after President Mandela discussed his case with the Zimbabwean President Robert Mugabe, leading to speculation that he might be treated leniently. The Brazilian Central Bank has announced that it's going to continue to allow the currency, the real, to float freely against the dollar. The announcement follows the real's dramatic devaluation last week, following weeks of intense pressure from financial markets. As our Brazil correspondent, Stephen Sveach, reports, the central bank statement means that the government has officially abandoned the cornerstone of 5 years of economic policy.
This is the final nail in the coffin for the strong real. For years, the Brazilian government insisted that the pegged currency was the only way to keep inflation down. Now, under overwhelming pressure from market forces, it has decided to give up the fight. In its statement, the central bank said it would only intervene occasionally to support the currency to prevent excessively wide fluctuations in its value. This new strategy was forced on the government, but some analysts are looking on the bright side, saying that at least now the authorities do not run the risk of losing all their foreign reserves. The truth is that no one knows whether the world's eighth largest economy has already been through the worst of the crisis or whether a new catastrophe is still to come.
Russian doctors say they're using drugs to treat President Yeltsin's bleeding stomach ulcer rather than surgery. The president was taken to hospital on Sunday. His spokesman said his condition was satisfactory and there was no question of his giving up any powers. The parliamentary speaker has urged Mr. Yeltsin to hand over some powers to the Prime Minister Yevgeny Primakov. BBC World Service News.
Following the widespread condemnation of Saturday's attack on the village of Ratchak in Kosovo, the Serbian authorities have denied it was a massacre of civilians. The Yugoslav ambassador in London, Miloš Radulović, says Serbian forces had been mounting a security operation against rebel fighters of the pro-independence Kosovo Liberation Army.
The facts are quite different. Our police forces informed Kosovo verifier missions about intention to arrest the group of terrorists because 5 days ago they killed a police officer. But when they approached the village, several terrorist groups opened heavy fire. They were not all in their uniforms with insignia of KLL. There were some in civilian uniforms.
Ambassador Radulović also said his government will not allow members of the International War Crimes Tribunal into Ratchak to investigate the killings.
Well, I don't think so, because what is going on in Kosovo is not a war, a war between two sides. There are terrorists and doing terrorist activities, and we are not obliged to allow these investigators to come to Kosovo because the situation is quite different.
I'm joined now on the line by Jamie Shea, NATO spokesman in Brussels. Jamie Shea, as you heard the Yugoslav ambassador in London just saying there, Belgrade is still very defiant in the face of widespread international criticism and condemnation.
Oh, yes, indeed, and regrettably so. If the Yugoslav government is so certain of the facts and is so certain of its version of events regarding this massacre, then why will it not allow the competent authority, the International Criminal Tribunal of The Hague, into Kosovo to carry out an objective investigation?
Well, the answer speaks for itself there, but NATO representatives are meeting with officials in Belgrade. Can you give us an update of where those discussions have reached?
Well, those discussions have not taken place yet. We expect them to happen in the next few hours, but the two NATO generals travelling to Belgrade will deliver a very clear message to the Yugoslav government that the type of violence that we've seen over the last couple of days has got to stop, and that the threat of NATO air operations is still very, very much in existence. We've never cancelled any of our planning to conduct those operations, and that the agreement that President Milosevic signed with NATO last October, and which provided for reduction of his security forces in Kosovo, has to be respected.
That's one of the conditions, presumably, that NATO is going to lay down. What are the other conditions, particularly as regards the War Crimes Tribunal trying to investigate the massacre?
Well, there are two UN Security Council resolutions which quite explicitly give the International Tribunal authority to conduct investigations in Kosovo. And so if President Milosevic does not allow the investigators in, he is breaching UN Security Council resolutions. Secondly, we demand that Milosevic immediately publicise the names of the individuals who carried out that massacre and those that gave the orders. It's not very difficult for President Milosevic to know who did this, and NATO is holding him personally responsible for the actions of his security forces. And we want those people, once they are identified, to be handed over to the tribunal to face justice.
And what about the international monitors, the verifiers of the Organisation for Security and Cooperation in Europe? I mean, by all reports, accounts, they've had to flee Ratchak. What is NATO going to demand of Milosevic as regards the OSCE?
Well, again, there is an explicit written agreement between Milosevic and the OSCE signed last December, in which he has pledged to allow the OSCE unrestricted access to Kosovo to do its work, to monitor the situation. And he has also agreed to provide security for those unarmed OSCE personnel. And we expect him to keep these agreements. The OSCE is playing an extremely important role at the moment, and a very courageous role, given the numbers and given the fact that they don't bear arms, in negotiating local ceasefires, in trying to dampen down the violence, and as acting, of course, as the eyes and ears of the international community. And NATO will support them in every way that it can.
Jamie Shea in Brussels, thank you very much. Now the BBC's Jackie Rowland joins us live on the line from the Kosovo capital, Pristina. Jackie Rowland, what is the situation from your end in Pristina? What, for instance, is the Kosovo leadership saying?
Well, it's quite clear that what's been going on in Kosovo is being seen essentially as a complete breakdown of the ceasefire. I mean, most of the discussions so far that you've been having have been focusing on the situation in Ratchak. Well, I'm hearing reports now from international ceasefire monitors that the situation is spreading to other villages in the area. They've described it to me as a concerted operation by the Serbian security forces. This is clearly an absolute act of defiance, and it shows that the Yugoslav authorities really don't care about the kind of NATO threats that Jamie Shea has just been describing to you.
Well, you just heard what Jamie Shea was saying, the conditions which NATO is going to lay down for Milosevic. Are those very clear conditions not sufficient to assuage the concerns of the ethnic Albanians in Kosovo?
Absolutely not, because I think that the ethnic Albanians in Kosovo are sick of hearing words from NATO, threats, final warnings. President Milosevic has received probably half a dozen final warnings. He's had plenty of these ultimatums. He doesn't take them seriously anymore. I think people here in Kosovo want to see NATO putting its money where its mouth is, because they just don't believe these kind of diplomatic political pronunciations any longer.
And very briefly, Jackie, presumably people are very keen that the prosecutor from the War Crimes Tribunal, Louise Arbour, is going to be allowed in to investigate reports of that massacre.
Well, in fact, we've just heard that she hasn't been allowed in. Justice Arbour has been turned back at the border, violating yet another point of the agreement that President Milosevic reached with the international community.
Jackie Rowland in the Kosovo capital, Pristina, thank you very much. Yet again, President Yeltsin's health is in the spotlight. This time, it's his stomach. He's said to be suffering from a bleeding stomach ulcer, and it's being treated in hospital. I've been speaking to Igor Ignatiev, a former chief of the Presidential Press Service until 1996, and now deputy managing editor of a Moscow weekly newspaper. I began by asking him how much President Yeltsin's latest illness was due to non-medical factors.
Well, I think in general it's a situation that is going on in the country. The necessity to take right now some unpopular decisions that probably should have been taken some time ago. And certainly it's causing some additional stress.
President Yeltsin in the past has been accused, admittedly by his opponents mostly, of being too fond of vodka. Do you think there's any substance to this claim, that he's now paying the price for his overindulgence in vodka?
As far as I know, for some long time he is not using these hard liquors. Maybe for his past usage of it, but I don't have such information.
So you admit he was a heavy drinker in the past?
No, I do not admit that he was a heavy drinker, but
it sounded like you were saying that, you see.
No, the only thing I said that for the time that I observed him at the close range during my work at Kremlin, I didn't have an example to see that he is a heavy drinker.
But for a man renowned in the past for his vigor and color, it must be very frustrating for him to be so physically incapacitated like this. You know, his recent public appearances of a man barely able to walk or stand unaided, speaking in a very slow, precise manner. How badly do you think his intellectual capabilities have been affected by his illnesses?
I do not think that his intellectual capacity was affected. He still has a very bright mind. He is thinking very clearly, and he still grasps the situation more even clearly than many of other politicians.
But how can you really say that when President Yeltsin hasn't even been in his Kremlin office this year? Large parts of his government business that involve him personally have been postponed or cancelled.
No, actually, President Yeltsin is well known as a real workaholic. He cannot have a genuine and full-time rest. Even being on his weekends, he reads a lot, he is thinking a lot, he phones a lot. So it's, for him personally, it doesn't matter whether he is at his Kremlin's office or somewhere else.
Igor Ignatiev, a former chief of the Presidential Press Service in Moscow. Coming up in the next 15 minutes, we'll be bringing you all the latest financial news, and Chile's former leader, Augusto Pinochet, waits to hear if he can look forward to returning home as Britain's most senior judges meet to decide his fate. And what has the sexually explicit language of the Anwar Ibrahim trial in Malaysia done to people's sensibilities there? You're listening to the BBC World Service. This is Zainab Badawi with NewsHour. So, the next chapter in the convoluted legal wrangle over General Pinochet's future begins in London today. Seven law lords are trying to decide if the former Chilean leader has immunity from prosecution. The case has been brought back to the House of Lords, Britain's highest court, after an earlier ruling that the general does not enjoy such immunity was set aside because one of the judges hadn't revealed his links to human rights organisations. Our correspondent in the Chilean capital, Santiago, James Reynolds, looks at what General Pinochet's supporters have been doing in the run-up to this latest round of legal arguments.
To the cheers of 200 of his supporters, a giant greetings card addressed to Augusto Pinochet is unveiled at a rally in Santiago. Once everyone signs it, the card will be delivered to General Pinochet in Britain. His supporters hope the Guinness Book of World Records will recognise it as the biggest ever greetings card to be sent. It's all part of an attempt to keep the campaign for General Pinochet's release going. General Pinochet's son, Augusto, was the first to sign the card. He calls on Britain to send his father home. I hope Britain knows what to do, he says. That it doesn't forget its good friendship with Chile, which has lasted for years. During the last month in Chile, public protests over General Pinochet's arrest have died down, but his supporters are still anxious to win over public opinion in Chile and abroad. One of them, Hermógenes Pérez de Arce, has just written a book in which he maintains that Augusto Pinochet is innocent of all the charges raised against him. The author wants the book to be published in Europe. He says that General Pinochet's lawyers in Britain haven't done enough to establish the former military leader's innocence.
Incluso sus propios abogados como que tenían la idea de que...
The general's own legal team, he says, agreed with the prosecution that Augusto Pinochet is guilty of serious crimes. I hope my book will show General Pinochet's lawyers that, in my opinion, he is innocent of the charges raised against him. A song for General Pinochet, part of an album just released by the Pinochet Foundation. It's part of an attempt to raise money for the former military leader's legal fees. Supporters are being asked to buy the album, to give money to a specially opened bank account, and to add a fixed donation to their monthly telephone bills. For those working at the Pinochet Foundation, there's been little rest over the last few months, but there's now a belief that the end may now be in sight. Marlene Schweitzer.
No, no hemos descansado ni un minuto, te digo. Estamos todos los días, desde 60, 70 días llevamos, estamos haciéndonos presentes en la...
We haven't taken a moment's break since he was arrested, she says. Every day we make our presence felt, on the streets, in the newspapers, and on television. We're now fairly optimistic that there'll be a solution to this problem, to this drama that we've been living. And several hundred Pinochet supporters are now travelling to London, what they hope will be the final stage in the legal proceedings against the man they call their liberator.
That was James Reynolds reporting from the Chilean capital, Santiago. This time, seven law lords instead of five are presiding over General Pinochet's appeal, and unlike the first time, the Chilean government will be given the opportunity to argue its case. The Spanish judge who requested the extradition of General Pinochet to Spain, Baltasar Garzón, is also attending the hearing. In the studio with me now is the lawyer, Mark Stevens. Mark Stevens, it's quite a difficult process for a lot of people to understand. So just explain to us legally, what can we expect from this hearing?
Well, what's actually being decided, Zainab, in this particular hearing is whether or not Augusto Pinochet is immune from prosecution in this country. Of course, if he was immune from prosecution, and that would mean that he couldn't stand trial for his extradition hearing to go to Spain to actually stand trial for the offences which the Spanish judge wishes to charge him.
And we have seven law lords instead of the original five presiding over this hearing. His fate obviously lies in the hands of these men. What do we know about them, their characters? How might they act?
Well, it's interesting. They are, by nature, a very conservative bunch, but even within that, they're probably four conservatives, three more moderates. But they've even brought one out of retirement, Lord Gough, and there's Lord Hutton from Northern Ireland, and also Lord Hope from Scotland's been drafted in to hear this particular hearing. But this isn't something that I think will be decided along straightforward decisions about whether you're a conservative or not. This is advanced legal thinking, and I think we're going to see perhaps moving into development of new areas of the law, and they're going to be worried about overriding the decision which they've already made, in effect, because they would look fairly stupid if they came out with one decision in the previous hearing, which they've obviously had to overturn, and then change that now.
General Pinochet's lawyers were obviously delighted that they had this rehearing, but why were they so pleased? I mean, does this rehearing actually increase his chances of avoiding extradition to Spain?
I don't think it does, and I think that the real key for that, for me, is the fact that the Chilean government, as you said, have now been given the opportunity of making representations. We're really bending over backwards to be seen to be fair in this particular case, to give all sides the chance to make their point of view. And of course, in those circumstances, I think that it's very likely that we're going to see General Pinochet going to Spain, subject, of course, to Jack Straw, who has to make the political decision yet again, deciding that he should go there rather than back to Santiago.
So, tell us, if the law lords say that General Pinochet does have immunity from prosecution, is he then free to leave straight away, no more appeals?
If he has immunity, yes, he can go straight off to Bryce Norton Air Base, where there's a Chilean Air Force plane waiting for him to whisk him straight back to Santiago.
I'm sure that's what he would like to happen, but we will have to wait and see. Mark Stevens, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Sodomy, adultery, graphic descriptions of sexual activity, homosexual and heterosexual. Well, this isn't the stuff that usually dominates the media or even private conversations in traditionally conservative Malaysia. But for the last 3 months, the news has been dominated by little else. It is all, of course, because of the trial of the country's sacked Deputy Prime Minister Anwar Ibrahim. Frances Harrison has been investigating the impact of the country's most sensational sex scandal on ordinary Malaysians.
Nightly TV news has had more discussion of sex than ever before.
He asked witness if there were sexual activities, judging from the number and sizes of the stains.
Lim, in his testimony yesterday, told the court that in the absence of vaginal stains found on the mattress, no sexual activity could have taken place. And today, Lim testified that based on his DNA results, several
sexual activities... For days, detailed quotes from the trial involved discussion of the semen-stained mattress, one of the main exhibits until the charges were amended. Asif Huda of the Financial Times newsletter says the sordid details have been played up by the local press to discredit Anwar Ibrahim politically. But he says there's no doubt coverage so far has shocked and confused the public.
I think this trial has had very considerable impact on very conservative society like Malaysia. For one thing, the Malaysians are not used to reading or hearing on their television words like sodomy and so on. So that really has transformed the society here.
Some people have reacted very negatively to the change. Rasma Bhupalan is a women's rights activist who's been appalled by what she sees as sensationalism and titillation.
We, the women, and many, many other citizens find that media should be more responsible and act responsibly. There is at all times no necessity to wallow in the mire of coarse, unbecoming, and sometimes quite, in my opinion, vulgar language.
As a former school principal, Rasma Bhupalan is worried about young children who watch the news and then ask their parents awkward questions, like what is sodomy?
To my mind, and I'm 71, I have never come across anything quite like this, not at all. And for 36 days or 40 days to be just going through person after person, sentence after sentence of evidence in this manner is something that we have never experienced before. And I don't think we ever want to experience this.
But there are those who've welcomed the explicit discussion of sex in the media. Chalko Vadaketh is a member of the Executive Committee of the Malaysian AIDS Council. He says until recently, AIDS messages couldn't mention the word condom on TV or radio. But he hopes the trial has set new parameters for what's acceptable.
I think we see a window of opportunity because one of our main aims is preventive education. And we have always felt hampered by so-called sensitivities of the Malaysian public. We also have very strong obscenity laws under our penal code, the Printing and Publications Act and the Broadcast Act and so on. So we've been hampered by having explicit information about, say, safer sex and so on. And now I think it'll be easier to talk about how to insert a condom onto a penis and so on.
This trial has divided Malaysian society, not just between those who support Anwar Ibrahim and those who don't, but also between those who think it's a time for a new era of openness and those who think some things are best kept private.
And that report from Francis Harrison in Malaysia. The mobile phone companies Vodafone of the UK and AirTouch of America have been giving details of their planned merger during the past hour. For more on that and the rest of the business news, here's Sally Hardcastle.
Regulatory authorities on both sides of the Atlantic have still to approve the merger, but both companies are confident that the $62 billion deal will go ahead. It will create a company worth $110 billion with operations in 23 countries and over 23 million customers. Today, the two companies predicted that 50% of the population in developed nations will be using mobiles by the year 2003. And Chris Gent, chief executive of Vodafone, believes all bodes well for a smooth as well as a profitable merger.
We know the management of AirTouch very well. We're partners with them in Sweden and in Egypt. We have a mutual attitude towards developing rapid growth in our business. There's a cultural affinity which I think will help us as we develop our joint partnership. There's very few growth markets like mobile telephony. We've done very well up to date, but there's immense opportunity in front of us. If you look at what's happened in Finland, they've already got over 57% of the population using mobile phones. In the UK, it's now 22.5%. And in the States, 23%. So there's huge growth potential just to take the level of adoption up to the kind of levels in Scandinavia.
Chris Gent. As you heard in the news, the Brazilian Central Bank has announced that it will continue to allow the country's currency, the real, to float freely against the dollar. The real was devalued last week, and the government said on Friday that the real would float against the dollar in the short term. Now the central bank has confirmed that it has given up the fight to defend the currency. Market forces will apply from now on with only occasional intervention to support the currency. On Friday alone, $321 million fled the Brazilian currency market. The loss so far this month is $5.4 billion. Currently, the real is trading at 1.47 to the dollar. That's more than 2% down from Friday. The World Trade Organization has told South Korea to change its taxes on imported alcoholic drinks. It's trying to end a long-running dispute with the European Union and the United States, which have complained that Korea discriminates against imported alcohol. The tax on a local liquor called soju is, for example, only 35%. Scotch whiskey, on the other hand, is taxed at 100% rate. It's too early to have a market reaction in the US to the news from Brazil. Last week's devaluation sent the market tumbling because the US does so much trade with the country. London likes the Vodafone news. It's up 1.8% at 60.47, with mobile phone shares performing strongly. Earlier, Tokyo's Nikkei average was up 0.5% at 13,805. In London, currency trading, the dollar is up 0.4 Japanese yen at 114.4 yen. The euro is at $1.16.1.
Thank you, Sally. Sally Hardcastle with the business news.